Hi, it's Heather Hurlburt at the National Security Network getting our Russia call started. We are still waiting for Mike McFaul, but we have Mark Brzezinski with us, so we're going to go ahead and get started because we know everyone's got lots going on today. Thanks a lot for joining us to talk about the Russian presidential elections and the future of U.S.-Russia relations, and we're really fortunate to have one and then eventually two of our foremost experts on Russia. And who we've got with us right now to start us off is Mark Brzezinski, who has served as both Director of Southeast European Affairs and Director for Russian-Eurasian Affairs on the National Security Council, in which capacity he coordinated U.S. democracy and rule of law assistance in Russia, the former Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe, which seems highly relevant to some of the challenges we're facing today. I know we've got several of you on the call, and we are, as I said, waiting for Mike. But, Mark, I think I might just let you go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Heather, and I want to thank our hosts this morning, the National Security Network, for organizing this call. The topic we're focusing on is important and timely. Sunday's election in Russia will mark a historic first. While the election of Dmitry Medvedev will not be the product of a fair competition of ideas, President Putin stepping aside is an important step in that he's the first ruler of Russia to have ever done so. That's important to institutionalizing regularity and respect for procedures, even if he does retain influence behind the scenes or in some official capacity. But we should be under no illusion that Sunday's elections will be democratic. A key feature of democratic elections is that the outcome isn't predictable, and we've been able to predict the outcome of this election for quite some time. In the next few minutes, I'd like to offer some general perspectives on these elections and what they mean, and then I'd be happy to go into more detail during Q&A. First, I don't think this election and the ascension of Medvedev will result in any significant change in policy. But I do think that domestically, the next Russian president is going to be confronted with a serious set of economic and social challenges. Putin has been able to consolidate the chaos that followed the fall of the Soviet Union, and the Russian economy has grown. Since 1999, the annual growth of Russia's GDP has exceeded 6.5%. At the same time, there's been no major investment in social infrastructure nor effort to address real social problems. As cash-rich as Russia is, its economy remains one-dimensional. It's an energy-exporting economy, and the infrastructure underpinning that industry is antiquated. Social conditions outside major cities are poor and primitive. The country faces a serious demographic crisis in which its population is declining by 700,000 per year, and that's of a population of 140 million, and aging, which maximizes economic and social weaknesses. Health tragedies like the transmission rate of AIDS and HIV are growing, and Russia ranks 136th in the world in terms of male life expectancy. So I think the new Russian president is going to be more absorbed in addressing domestic issues than the image of a cash-rich Russia lends itself today. Second, in terms of U.S.-Russian relations, some have suggested that America and Russia are moving towards a confrontation of a Cold War type. I don't agree with that characterization. It's true that Russia and America have missed the possibility of a broader accommodation, which had been hoped for a decade ago when there was a vision of a Russia-U.S. collaboration based on shared values to advance global security and expand the Euro-Atlantic community. Instead, what exists today is cold peace. I think that cold peace is partly a product of Russia's internal and rather difficult historical transition, and partly a product of the challenges America finds itself in today. Russia is in the process of moving from an imperial consciousness, which has defined it over the centuries, to being a national state with nationalism as a source of internal unity. As a consequence, it has regional ambitions. And that's seen in some of Russia's heavy-handed actions towards Estonia, Ukraine, and Georgia. A sense of imperial nostalgia has motivated the Kremlin, and one should not underestimate Russia's resentment over the fall of the Soviet Union. Putin himself has called it the greatest disaster of the 20th century. While this has been going on, and in the face of general anti-democratic regression in Russian political life, the U.S., consumed as it's been by the war in Iraq and challenges elsewhere, has been rather passive. The feigning of friendship between Presidents Putin and Bush, starting when President Bush peered into Putin's soul and saw a Democrat, hasn't helped. After a number of comments, including Secretary Rice declaring not too long ago that U.S.-Russian relations are the best in history, it seemed to the Bush administration wishful thinking and expedient sloganeering can replace strategy in terms of how to approach Russia. Despite his freedom agenda, President Bush was silent when early signs of Putin's rollback of democracy were clear, and therefore helped to create an impression among Kremlin leaders that Putin's rollback of democracy would be ignored because of Russia's strategic value. More recently, an emboldened President Putin has railed against American, quote, hyperpower, and has threatened to point Russian nuclear weapons at Europe. Given these circumstances, where do we go from here? The U.S. should work to create a context in which a future, more sober Kremlin leadership recognizes that a Russia linked more closely to the Euro-Atlantic community will be more prosperous, more democratic, and territorially more secure. In particular, U.S. strategy should reflect not a one-dimensional approach, but a mixed nature of shared as well as conflicting interests that we have with Russia. Nonproliferation, counterterrorism, international health, global economic stability, those are clearly shared interests. And in the area of counterproliferation, in some ways, our policy reflects that now, as seen in the Nunn-Lugar program. Growing economic interdependence should be welcomed. WTO is coming along, and before long, Russia will enter. The U.S. government should avoid careless irritants like the ham-handed way it has presented the missile defense system it would like to deploy next door to Russia. But at the same time, we must be clear in our support for the new states around Russia in the preservation of their independence. A Council of Europe report urged Russia to stop treating, quote, neighboring and other countries in the region as zones of special interest and to cease activities which undermine their sovereignty. We should tell the Russians it would be good if your neighbors feared you less. It's in Russia's interest and in America's for there to be greater trust and cooperation between Russia and her neighbors. The U.S. should strive to get Russia to understand that it's not pursuing a policy to transform the region into a zone of American control through color revolutions. Instead, what's been happening there is part of a process of what's been happening in Europe for more than 50 years. And we should say to the Russians, the road to the West is open to you. And it would be worth pursuing with Russia some shared engagement in the development of a Euro-Atlantic community that embraces Russia. That's a vision that would attract many Russians who know their standard of living is much lower than the West and that their society does not flourish in isolation. Let me close by saying that in the longer term, I'm optimistic and positive about U.S.-Russian relations. I think it's possible that Putinism may be the last gasp of the old regime, and it may well be the case that within a decade, the Putin-Medvedev government may be replaced by a new generation of Russians, many of them trained in the West. You see them in U.S. and European universities who are not products of the KGB and more open to the West. Let me stop right there and turn it over to Mike, and then we'll do Q&A.
Great. Mark, thank you so much for starting us off with such a comprehensive overview, and I'm really glad to welcome to the call Michael McFaul, who, as you probably already know, is the Peter and Helen Bing Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Political Science at Stanford, non-resident associate at the Carnegie Endowment, and very well-known Russia expert. Michael, I will just let you jump in and talk to our folks about your views on what we see going on with the presidential elections and what's ahead for U.S. relations with Russia.
Okay, thanks, Heather. And I'll be going to be very brief. I had written down that we were on for 11 a.m. California time, so I apologize for getting on late. Mark's given a big overview, and I don't want to go over the same things. We agree on a lot. I think that's a nice framework. I'd just say a couple of things to add. First, let's just remember the obvious. The people of Russia are not choosing a presidential candidate on Sunday. Vladimir Putin did that several weeks ago. This, in my opinion, I write about elections. I've been at every Russian election since 1990, I think, except for this one. In my opinion, is the least competitive election in Russia's post-communist history. So that's an important thing to remember. And you know, several years ago, we had a debate about whether Russia was on an autocratic path or not. That debate now, I think, is over in the West, and we realize that this is just a, you know, some people want to use adjectives, say it's a weak autocracy, soft autocracy, but the word autocracy is the noun now rather than democracy being qualified. And that, by the way, I think this is, you see this among all presidential candidates. I don't think Senator McCain, Obama, or Clinton fundamentally have a different interpretation of what is going on inside Russia. And in their last presidential debate, both Senator Clinton and Obama started and led with this observation. Where the breakdown, of course, comes is what to do about this situation and how we got here. I agree with Mark about what he said about the Bush administration. They had a very classic realpolitik view of how to deal with Russia. And, you know, for a while it worked, and it was the following. Bush said, okay, I'm going to reach out to this guy, Putin. I'm going to make him feel comfortable. I'm going to make him feel like he's my friend. And you recall that's what he did when he first met with him. I actually happened to meet with the president just before that meeting that he had in 2001, and it was very clear to me that reaching out to Putin to get their foreign policy objectives, that's what they're going to do. They're not going to worry about independent media, Chechnya, et cetera. Now, I know it's going to sound like ancient history, but you got to remember back then what they were seeking to achieve, that is the Bush administration, was to get out of the ABM treaty and to start building ballistic missile defenses. And initially, they got that from Putin. And then after September 11th, they also had his cooperation and acquiescence in terms of fighting the war in Afghanistan. And then everything ends. Basically, two things happened that have got us to where we are today. On the Russian side, they thought they were entering into a new strategic alliance in a kind of Sam Huntington-esque clash of civilizations in the global war on terrorism. That's the way they framed it. And some people, I think, even framed it in ethnic and racist terms in Moscow in those early years. And we didn't step up to the plate, and we didn't deliver on that. Being the United States, had different interests. And then most fatally for this vision that you had inside Moscow was the Iraq War. And ever since then, Mr. Putin and the people around him now define foreign policy fundamentally. I would say that the overriding strategic objective of Russian foreign policy today is to balance against what they would call American hegemon. And it's very zero sum. If it's good for the U.S., it's bad for Russia and vice versa. That's the central, if you will, overriding objective of Russian foreign policy, which is fundamentally different than it was under Gorbachev and Yeltsin in the early years of Putin, when that was integration with the West. So that's a big, important thing, and I think it's going to take a long time to change that. And then second, of course, what you had was growing autocracy inside Russia, and I don't think that's just a coincidence that as you had growing autocracy inside Russia, you had more strained relations with the West. Now, you go back to 2003, and you remember the so-called alliance between France, Germany, and Russia leading up to the war in Iraq, and people speculating about a new balance of power in Europe versus, you know, the Brits and the Poles, and add the Americans to that. That all looks really silly in retrospect. That did not hold up. That did not have a long-term alliance structure. Instead, what you see today, I think, is rather a lot of unity among Europeans and the United States today in terms of worrying about what happens inside Russia. But finally, what to do about Russia? I'm cautiously optimistic about Mr. Medvedev, but I'm cautiously optimistic all the time. I come from Montana. We're optimistic people. He's saying all the right things. He had an important speech a couple of weeks ago where, if you read it closely, it's really a denunciation of the Putin era. So I want to be open. I have close Russian friends of mine who know him well. I personally don't know him well at all, who say that he is pro-Western, he is a liberal, and he is the other camp, if you will, between the liberals on the one hand and the KGB guys on the other that have been around Mr. Putin. So, you know, I will hope for the best. I'll also remind you all, though, that if you go back and you read President Putin's inaugural address in the year 2000, you'll see a lot of nice words about democracy and deepening civil society commitment there as well. I think the more pragmatic prediction is that he's going to be a weak president. Putin loves foreign policy. Medvedev has no experience in foreign policy. And I don't think in the next coming several months you're going to see a fundamental change in Russia's foreign policy behavior. On our side, I think there's two choices. There's one choice, one argument that says this has happened, it's bad. What we need to go back to now is a policy of neo-containment, isolation, kicking Russia out of the G8, and trying to protect the democracies on Russia's borders. There's a second view, and I think I'm in the second camp, which says, look, we really don't have the means available to pursue a policy of containment and isolation. And second, that's really not going to help the Democrats inside Russia. So what would be better is a much more constructive bilateral relationship with some substance that has been missing. Because the Bush one point. One other thing that happened after September 11th is the Bush administration simply stopped thinking about Russia, has really had little time to put any energy into this bilateral relationship. And because of that neglect, we're where we're at today, which is, I think, probably the worst bilateral relations we've had with Russia in 20 years. So if you had a more constructive relationship along the lines that Mark already outlined, where you really were talking about something, there was something to talk about at these summits instead of just talking about fishing and kind of silly stuff. And I think first and foremost, the focus has to be on the reduction of our nuclear arsenals in both countries. That's something, by the way, that makes Russia special, because they're the one country in the world that has such a large nuclear arsenal besides us. And if you had the focus on that, where you did something concrete, I think somewhat paradoxically that would create more permissive conditions for doing more to help Russia's civil society leaders and democratic optimists. And I would just remind you about the Soviet days. The Soviet Union did not collapse at a time when they were isolated and lots of confrontational rhetoric. The Soviet Union collapsed when Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan were embracing each other. And when you had better relations at the top between the two states, that actually helped to loosen society inside the Soviet Union. So I think of those two options, without being naive about how fast change will occur again inside Russia, I think the second is a much more productive way. Thank you.
Great. Thank you both very much. And we would now love to let the reporters on the line ask some questions. So,
certainly. If anyone on the line would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch tone phone to be placed into the queue. If at any time your question has been answered, you may press the pound key to remove yourself. Once again, it is star and then one on your touch tone phone to be placed into the queue to ask a question.
Great.
And we'll give it a few seconds for the Q&A to queue up.
While we're waiting, does either of you want to say anything about understanding of Russia in the United States and where we are or aren't or ought to be in terms of focusing on the issue? Mark, you and I were talking about this a little before the call.
Well, I think that Mike touched on something that was very important, and that was the limited bandwidth at the top of the U.S. government in terms of dealing with major foreign policy challenges. And I think that's at least part of the reason why we have lacked a Russia strategy for the last 7 years. For better or worse, American foreign policy for the last 7 years has been mostly about Iraq. And that's understandable given the sacrifice of our troops and the amount in blood and treasure that we're spending there. But America should have a more dynamic global agenda, including a Russia policy. And in certain ways, we've been following and not leading when it comes to challenges presented by Russia. And I think we've missed an opportunity to have a more constructive approach to Putin. I don't think we could have avoided all problems, but I think we could be in a better place than where we are now.
Mike, did you want to add anything to that?
Maybe just two quick points. I mean, one real problem we have that is structural with Russia today is that when you're sitting in Russia and you're working for the president, or you're a pundit or an analyst, or you work at some equivalent of a think tank in Moscow, the number one bilateral relationship for Russia is with the United States, right? So they've got lots of folks thinking about U.S.-Russian relations, and that's the central, you know, that's the central bilateral relationship that matters to them, not either positive or negative, but that's the big one for them. When you get back to Washington, it's not. I'm not even sure it makes the top 10 today. And that asymmetry is something that the Russians don't understand. They think, you know, you watch Russian television, and you would think that we are plotting this grand campaign to weaken Russia, to destroy Russia, to foment these colored revolutions, as Mark said, all over the place. And I know all the senior foreign policy people for the Bush administration on Russia, and I can tell you that that is not what they're doing, and the folks above them have barely any time to think about Russia at all, as Mark said. The second big thing, though, I think there's a very dangerous mythology about Russia. You asked about our understanding of Russia. Big mythology about Putin being the stabilizer, Putin being the guy that turned the Russian economy around, and this notion that autocracy has been good for economic growth. In fact, there was just in the New York Times an excellent piece, by the way, on democratic erosion in Nizhny Novgorod just 2 days ago. The subheading of that article was "Rising Autocracy Causes Growth" or something like that. Even though there was not a single fact in the article that had anything to do with that. That, I think, is wrong, because that, I think, and I've written about this. I have a piece in the last edition of Foreign Affairs trying to unpack this, but I think it's dangerous because it serves as an excuse, if you will, or a rationale for why it's okay to undermine democracy, because this autocracy has these other benefits.
Great.
And I don't see those benefits.
Thanks. We've got a question?
Certainly. We'll take our next question from the side of David Sands. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks for your time there. Since it came up at President Bush's press conference, I wonder if you all would hazard a guess on who you think is going to represent Russia at the G8 conference this summer. And also, could you go a little bit more into that comment you had about Medvedev's speech, in some ways a repudiation of the Putin era?
Is this for me or Mark?
I'll pick whoever.
Yeah,
Mike,
go ahead if you'd like. I would assume that since presidents represent countries at the G8, that it would be Medvedev, but that remains to be seen. I, other than past history informing me, I don't have anything to offer on that. I do think, though, that I just want to kind of revisit something that pertains to your question. It's something that Mike alluded to earlier, and that is perceptions and understanding of Russia on this end, because you do hear allusions in the popular press about a Kremlin master plan guiding Russia's actions domestically and toward her neighbors. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think Russia's actions are driven variably by ambition and nostalgia, misinformation and confusion, irritation and resentment. And I just wanted to kind of put that on the record as well. I think that there is a misunderstanding here in terms of what drives Kremlin policymaking. And that will inform the approach I described will inform how Russia approaches the G8.
David, I just grabbed the speech. Let me give you a couple of quotes that just to me really jumped out. He said, for instance, this is the principle that the existence of freedom is better than its absence, talking about the reforms that he seeks to do. Then he goes on to quote Catherine the Great, of all people, because she wasn't exactly a great Democrat, but saying freedom is the soul of all things, and without it, it's as if all is dead. I want obedience to the laws, but not to the laws for slaves. And then this next one is really the exact opposite of what President Putin ran in the parliamentary elections, where he basically, the grand narrative of that election was there was chaos in the 90s, it was this awful time, and then I came in and restored order. Mm-hmm. And Medvedev says, freedom does not mean chaos, but respect for the country's laws. And then he goes on and relates why freedom is positive for order and not just this negative of order. So, and you've got to remember, he is a lawyer. He spends a lot of time in this speech talking about how they, you know, there's been a kind of nihilistic relationship with law in the country that has to change. He says corruption is the number one problem in Russia today, and that's after 8 years of Putin's presidency. So, you know, it was a striking speech in terms of those kinds of statements. Oh, and if I could add one other thing, I'm sorry. When he talks about corruption, he then rightly says, in my opinion, you know, the way you fight it is with accurate information, quote, you know, which is we must protect the real independence of the media, which provides the channels for feedback between society as a whole and the state authorities. I mean, that's right out of a Mike McFaul article talking about the relationship between an independent media and corruption. Now, you know, words are cheap when you're running for president, but these are, you know, striking words, especially against the backdrop of what has happened over the last 8 years.
Great. If we have any more questions.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star and then one on your touch-tone phone to be placed into the queue.
Okay. Well, we'll give it one more second to see if anyone else has a question, but I think that's been a pretty magisterial set of presentations. If there's no more questions, and unless either of you has something burning to say to still jump in, why don't we thank everyone very much for getting on this call, and hope you'll come back to us at National Security Network in the future as we take on this and other issues. I have a feeling we'll be revisiting this issue again during the year and hopefully even hearing from these two gentlemen ahead. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.